Excuse me, this is the operator. This call is now being recorded.
This is Glenn. On the call, we have Ray Fassett, Fidoria, Wolf Ulrich Snowben, Steve Metallis, and for staff, we have Julie Edlund, Ken Bauer, and Glenn de Saint-Gerie. Thank you, Ray.
Okay. Well, first of all, I'd like to thank Steve for joining us today. And
sure.
And Wolf, I think you were about to make a comment.
Yes, thank you, Ray. And just about the question of the 25th, which is today, which is in the resolution we passed on council level, I would suggest just give Chuck a call. So he should be aware of that. So maybe in the next council meeting he comes back to that in 3 weeks, but I don't think that we really need a formal resolution. But just check with Chuck, and that could be solved.
Yes, and I think today's call, especially with Steve on, is going to really help our work team in the direction we're going to go. I quickly, just shortly ago, sent out a summary, hopefully articulated the issue of where we're at on the conflicts of interest, not firm, just where we sort of landed and we needed more guidance on the distinction being conflicts of interest as this pertains at the stakeholder group level versus a conflict of interest at the council level. And I think Steve is up to speed on this point. Steve, can I defer to you to jump right in? I'm sure your schedule is busy.
Yeah. Thank you for sending this note around earlier today. It's very helpful. Let me just clarify a couple of things. First of all, when you say solve at the stakeholder group level, one thing we don't know much about how stakeholder groups are going to function, we know one thing. They're all different. Two of them are really the constituencies in the old system, and they just changed their names. The other two are quite different from anything that's existed before. I can tell you that there is no way that that conflicts will be even addressed at the stakeholder group level in the commercial stakeholder group, at least at present, because council representative positions aren't even worked out. Positions on issues are not even worked out at the stakeholder group level. They're worked out at the constituency level. And while there may well be discussion at the stakeholder group level, it's meaningless to say that the stakeholder group will have anything. It will necessarily have anything to say about the position taken by, for example, David Taylor, who is a representative, and I think would see himself as he's elected by, and he would see himself as responsible to the IP constituency, not to the commercial stakeholder group. Now, that may change over time. This is kind of an interim arrangement, and I think there is some discussion about having a more integrated stakeholder group, but right now that's not the case, and I would not even try to speak for the non-commercial stakeholder group on this. So I think the premise here that the stakeholder group level is at all relevant may need to be re-examined.
Okay, so let me see if I understand. So, I'm in the contracted party house, so
right.
Things aren't as complicated. But
right.
When I look over into the other house, we have stakeholder groups that are comprised of different constituencies.
Right. Yeah.
And
well,
and
true in the commercial side. Yeah.
Yeah. So trying to get an elected rep of the stakeholder group to represent the views of all the various constituencies that may form that stakeholder group is not as easy as we might be assuming. Is that pretty much it?
Yeah. Well, it's just that they're not there to represent the views of the stakeholder group. They're there, at least within the commercial stakeholder group at this point, they're there to represent the views of their constituency.
Ray,
so,
can I jump in?
This is Aubrey, if I can add something also.
Okay, so we have a queue. Who is the first one there before Aubrey?
Ray, it's Christina. I just wanted to let you know I've just joined.
That's wonderful. Okay. Who was the first one in the queue there?
It was Ken.
Ken, please go ahead, and then was it Aubrey? Yes. Go ahead, Ken.
Yeah, I just wanted to see if we can make a differentiation here between constituencies and stakeholder groups. Where the stakeholder groups have not yet sort of fully fleshed out their role vis-a-vis the councilors and their decisions, I think the issue we're considering here is if a councilor has a conflict of interest in a voting matter on the council, can he or she appeal to, whether it's constituency or stakeholder group, that organization to which they have they owe their sort of allegiance or their voting representation, and ask them for a direction so as to eliminate the conflict? Maybe the problem here is we use the term stakeholder group, but we meant constituency or stakeholder group, whichever is appropriate.
Yes.
Fair. That's fair. Yes, I think that's correct. Aubrey?
Yeah, I was going to say two things. One, I was going to say basically what Ken just said, that stakeholder group is really just a stand-in for group you are responsible to. The other thing is just speaking on the NTSG side, where I'm on the its executive committee, is it's still being discussed whether they'll be SG-wide or whether there'll be some notion of constituency. I think it's tending towards SG-wide council members. And, of course, for the next year, we're in that funny situation of two coming out of, you know, the NCUC, I mean, three coming out of the NCUC and three being board-appointed. So, obviously, the board-appointed ones fall completely outside these categories.
Okay, so let me see if I can rephrase the question to Steve and Christina. Is there, are there remedies, all right, is it true that at the council level, the rep, regardless of where they are coming from, are intended to be representing a membership group as a whole versus an individual position? And if that's true, are there ways to resolve the conflicts before the council level?
Well, I think that reformulation that what Ken suggested is, this is Steve.
Yes.
I think that reformulation that Ken suggested is helpful. And let me just say, from the standpoint of the IP constituency, we do give guidance to our council members as much as possible. On issues that are coming up before the council. But we've basically elected these councilors also to exercise their judgment, and in some cases, it's not really feasible to give them very detailed guidance just because of schedules and timetables and
yes,
amendments and so forth that come up. So I agree with you that If Christina, let's say, as one of our representatives, has a conflict and is therefore feels she's unable to vote on a particular matter, the first thing I would hope she would raise that at the constituency level, and we could try to figure out what to do about it. But I'm not sure that the idea that she would say, I'm conflicted, but if you tell me what to do, I can do what you tell me to do.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that necessarily mm-hmm. resolves the problem. First, mm-hmm. because there are going to be some circumstances in our constituency anyway where the constituency really doesn't tell the council member what to do, at least not in detail. And second, I think, which may be a broader problem, is that I'm not sure from a professional responsibility standpoint, and both of our council representatives happen to be lawyers, but I'm not sure from a professional responsibility standpoint that someone can resolve a situation in which she is conflicted by saying, I'm not voting what my personal preference is, I'm voting the will of my constituency.
And I've actually consulted with the chair of our professional responsibility committee, and, you know, again, this is just for my particular situation. You know, it is their view that it doesn't matter if I am on the council in a representative capacity. If I have a conflict in an individual capacity, I cannot, you know, taking the position that, well, I'm not voting as an individual, I'm voting on behalf of the constituency does not avoid the conflict. And moreover, going to the other point about consulting with the constituency as to how to proceed, if I have a conflict, I have a conflict. And the constituency saying, we disagree that it's a conflict, or we acknowledge your concerns about a conflict, but we still want you to do that, that is not a route that I can follow.
No, I agree. This is Ray. So I'm going to offer this sort of suggestion and see what you guys think on this issue. The issue to me appears still to be at the stakeholder group level, so it becomes a remedy for the stakeholder group to have to solve the conflict, and it could be passing the vote where the council rep discloses the conflict, not necessarily open for debate within that constituency or group, just that I'm telling you folks, I have one, I need to be relieved of this one, where then the stakeholder group or constituency has an option now where they can pass that vote to a different rep who doesn't have the conflict.
Which is fine, but then you would need to amend the council bylaws to expand the categories of situations in which proxy votes are permitted.
Well, actually, we don't even have anything
to encompass.
Proxy votes now. Yeah, we don't have anything in there for proxy votes at all.
No, I think there's proxies in the council bylaws.
No,
but that's someone voting. This is not really a proxy situation. This is an alternate situation.
An alternate,
basically,
yeah.
You're
yeah.
basically saying, you know, Christina was saying, I can't vote, and
right.
So if the IP constituency had elected an alternate, whose only job it is to vote and participate in a case in which one or the other of our constituency representatives is conflicted, then that would be fine, I think. Assuming that person is not conflicted, we don't have that in our bylaws now. We could put it there, but then the other question would be the council would have to say, oh, who's this person popping up to vote in place of Christina? I mean, you know, the council would have to obviously approve of that type of arrangement.
Well, I think we would go to the operating procedures,
yeah,
and we would describe the situation at hand, and in these instances, a stakeholder group would be permitted to do these things if they choose to run. Now, if the stakeholder group or constituency doesn't change their charter or doesn't change their methods, we're putting the rules of procedure could put the onus on the stakeholder group. If this is the issue that's being brought forward, put the onus on the stakeholder group to modify their own operations to solve the problem.
Yeah, I'm comfortable with that. I mean, assuming it's stakeholder group / constituency,
yeah.
But that would certainly solve that problem. The stakeholder group would have the choice of either, you know, having an alternate who could step in or not. If the answer is not, then we have the other problem, which is our constituency is only going to get one vote instead of two votes, but.
Well, no,
what's the denominator?
In that case, I mean, the option was provided. The stakeholder group chose, for whatever reason, chose not. I mean, the burden is on the stakeholder group. If the stakeholder group chose not to invoke it, they at that point would be faced with an abstention at the council level. And I don't think it's reasonable, since the burden was not exercised by the stakeholder group or constituency, to then say, well, we're going to adjust the threshold count on the denominator.
Well, no, I'm taking this now from Christina's point of view, and she can correct me if I'm wrong. But I think if she has a conflict, then and doesn't vote, then her not voting shouldn't have any influence on the outcome. And if her not voting is counted as a no vote, in practical terms, in other words, if the denominator is not changed,
right,
then she may have, you know, it may affect the outcome, and I don't know whether that's consistent with her professional.
Ray, this is Ken. Can I pop in there?
Yeah, please, Ken.
Yeah. So the way that I drafted the set of procedures that the team is actually considering at the moment is step one is to attempt by all reasonable means to resolve the conflict. We discussed two ways to do that that are actually specified in these procedures. And in the case of an attorney, perhaps, you know, maybe the first one, which would be directed to vote a certain way, doesn't work. But it might work in other situations where somebody is not an attorney and not held to a professional code of ethics or standard. And so that one would still, I think, potentially play a role where the constituency and or stakeholder group could say, do this, and therefore you're absolved. If that doesn't work, then we have alternative B, which is the constituency and or stakeholder group chooses an alternate person to register their vote on behalf of the conflicted individual. If that doesn't work, I can't remember if there were any other, I don't think there were any other ways out of the situation that we thought of yet. If that doesn't happen, then what the procedure says is the vote shall be recorded as an abstention and the denominator shall be reduced by one.
Okay.
That's what I wrote already. So there is a provision in there that if all reasonable efforts fail to avoid the conflict, well, then, yeah, you have to go by a full abstention, and you got to take that denominator and change it.
This is Albert. Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Okay. First of all, actually, the first one is a statement and not a question, although maybe it's a question. If, you know, the idea that lawyers are held to a certain standard and the rest of us may not be, I think ends up sort of a moot point, because at any point we would be saying, well, I don't have to be as moral or as abstentious in doing this as a lawyer would. So then anybody is sort of incurring a conflict of interest risk simply by not picking the standard, the highest standard possible. So I think that becomes sort of a moot point. On the second one, the whole notion of having an alternative come in, which is similar to the proxy vote but not, has that been cleared with legal staff as a notion? Because I know we had specifically legal staff issues with the use of a proxy vote. Now, I don't know if that was because we haven't defined it strictly enough or because proxy vote was in some inherent way problematic. And so I'm just wondering if this substitute suggestion has already been cleared by them and whether there are special conditions that would need to be identified that would make it, strictly speaking, acceptable, because we're talking about decisions that have to do with things like contracts. So you know, and that whole that whole serious level of making it acceptable. So I'm curious. Thanks.
Well, this is Ray. My first response to the second question is no. We have not. This has not even been floated as a kite through ICANN staff legal. It would have to do that once we, as a work team, as a sort of a policy position, came up with this is what our chosen approach is, and then we would run it through ICANN legal. So I don't think we're there yet.
Hello?
Yes. Anybody have a comment?
Sorry, Ray, this is Eric. I just joined the call.
Okay. Thank you, Eric. Okay, so, you know, where I'm still, I think our work team could really use some help. Is now, Ken, on your three options there, you know, one of your options was every reasonable means was exercised, and in the case of not all reasonable means exercised, in case of that, after all reasonable means have been exercised, then the third one would pop in, which is an abstention can be recorded at the council level, which would then change the denominator. Now, my question to you is, if that third option is out there, how do we ensure that the reasonable options that preceded it were, in fact, followed through?
That's a good question. This is Ken. I didn't think about that and didn't provide for it in the, at least what's been written so far. I do want to raise another element in that mix of options to be exercised. That one of the things that we also added, and I think Steve and Christina might have an opinion about this too, is we said that if all reasonable means are exercised, and we'll take a separate question as to whether we can prove that that's the case or not. And so the conflict remains, and it can't be avoided, and so we register an abstention. The next thing that we said was that the House that did not have the conflicted individual had to approve by majority vote that the denominator should in fact change.
Absolutely not.
Yeah, that's what we wrote, so go ahead, guys, have at it.
I mean, it's just, you know, I guess what I'm having, the problem that I have is that, you know, not only are these professional obligations not only to ensure that, you know, to my clients and to my ability to practice law, but, you know, worst case scenario, we're talking malpractice live exposure for my entire firm, you know, all however many employees and lawyers. So, you know, I frankly could care less what the contracted party stakeholder group has to say about whether or not they believe I do or do not have a conflict, mm-hmm. and whether or not my abstention does not count. It really comes down to if the Professional Responsibility Committee here, who I do consult with, you know, regularly just to ensure that there are no issues, if it's their determination that I have a conflict, that's the end of the discussion as far mm-hmm. as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. And it may actually sometimes be the case, and Ken, I wanted to get some information from you as to what you mean by reasonable measures, because it is in fact possible that in some cases the conflict, the basis for the conflict is something that is confidential and I can't disclose.
Yeah, let me throw this question out to the work team. We have myself, Avery, Wolf, Eric. So let's just do a litmus test here on this question here that Christina is raising a point to. How strong are we on this option of having to go to the other house for the approval? Does anybody feel strongly that that is something we really need to put our stake in the ground and feel is has to be part of this? Anybody have any comments on that?
Hi, this is Avery.
Avery, yes.
I certainly don't. I don't know how we, you know, confirm or just accept, you know, the truth of somebody swearing on a stack of their version of the Bible that, yes, they have a conflict of interest. I totally accept that conflict of interest could well be confidential. I'm assuming that saying there's a conflict of interest is not confidential, otherwise we really do have a problem.
Right, right.
But,
no, yeah, absolutely.
Right. But I accept that, and I think that, you know, council members have to accept that when somebody is saying something like that, they're telling the truth. And if at a certain point there, you know, it happens all the time and it becomes really problematic, or one notices a pattern of behavior that says, well, maybe there is something fishy there, then you deal with that differently. But I think if somebody says, hey, I've got a conflict of interest and it's serious and either I can or I can't tell you about it, it has to be accepted.
Yes.
Yes?
Wolf?
Yes, Wolf.
Yes. I'm just thinking, not so in detail, so issues. I'm just thinking where we came from and what we would like to have. So I understand, you know, we came as our team, we came to the point that we said, okay, conflict of interest should be accepted, but the question is what is the conflict of interest in this case? So that means so we are a little bit unsure about that. So we would like to have some guidance on that. So what we are expecting or we're also discussing was, do we have any criteria about, so, and do we expect, let me say, many different kind of cases where somebody could come up and only say, okay, I have a problem with a conflict of interest and that's it, and I would like to have to abstain from voting. So we wouldn't like to open that door too much. So just you would like to narrow that door. That's how I see that. So for me the question is, and that's my question to Christina and Steve. do you expect from your point of view many different cases? So if it could come up, so, and if that is the case, could we find some criteria which we could lay down in the rules of procedures where we can have a kind of guidance or not measurement, but a kind of guidance how to see, okay, that is could be a conflict of interest which is now in our list, let me say, which of rules of procedure, and which has been accepted already and which should be accepted also in future. And we could update this kind of list also throughout our meetings if a new kind of conflict arises. Why not? So that's my question. Do you really expect many different kind of conflicts here?
I mean, you know, it hasn't happened yet. And in terms of specific kinds, you know, obviously the facts are going to vary, but I think ultimately you're getting to whether or not the particular vote, whatever it is that's being voted on, is going to have a direct, you know, I think it would really go to, you know, is a client engaged in a transaction or in litigation?
So last time we differentiated between, let me say, so-called materialized conflict of interest. So that means what you would like to see in the team is, okay, there is material behind that conflict, really. So that's not only an argument, you know, to hide something, but it's really materialized.
My concern about doing that, though, is that, you know, I have an obligation to not only avoid actual conflicts, but also the appearance of impropriety. And that's where I think applying that materiality standard that I think you're trying to get at, Wolf, is going to be very difficult to do.
If I can jump in here and answer. Oh, go ahead, Steve.
No, I was just going to provide my perspective on Wolf's question. I think one reason this hasn't come up is because I think when people stand as candidates for the council, they are thinking about this, and the voters, if you will, they ought to be thinking about it. And I can reflect back that at one point when the GNSO council was selecting one of the people to go on the ICANN board, we instructed our representatives in that case to vote against somebody or not support somebody because we thought that person was too likely to have conflicts that would prevent the person from actually participating actively as a board member. And there was too much chance on which that person would have to be recused, and therefore that wouldn't be a good situation. So, you know, one way to deal with this problem is to ask candidates for these positions to be as candid as they can be about whether they foresee, you know, what they see as the likelihood that they would be conflicted. Now, a conflict situation certainly may arise after the election, so this is not a panacea, but I think this is one way to try to deal with this problem, which is, and I don't know exactly how to, whether, you know, there would be some type of message or something like that that said to either the stakeholder group or the constituency, whoever is selecting these people, bear in mind that if you want somebody who is unlikely to have too many conflicts that will require them to abstain.
Right.
But I think, you know, at least, you know, just speaking for me and for David, because David and I did talk about this before he decided to run, I mean, that was absolutely a consideration. You know, do I have any conflicts here? Because if you have conflicts going in, there, you know, at a certain point, there's no point to doing it.
Yeah, right.
You know, because you effectively can't you essentially can't participate, and you're also having to make public your inability to participate. So that doesn't really benefit anyone. So I think there is a lot of kind of self-filtering on the front end. But Steve's absolutely right. I mean, who knows what we're going to be voting on a year from now.
Um,
I think Eric Williams.
Can I ask a question? Okay, thanks.
Eric, then Aubrey.
Thank you, Ray. We're back, I think, to where we were about a month ago when I explained that I thought that the abstentions should not result in changes to the denominator and that we couldn't look inside them. And I'm really glad that Christina spoke to this issue at Seoul and is speaking to the issue today, because she, I didn't have her exactly in mind, but every scenario she's discussed is what I did have in mind. That's it.
Okay, thank you. Aubrey?
Yes, the question I have, and one of the criteria that I had mentioned when we talked about this in the past, is that I would think in any case where a vote came up and someone had to abstain, they would have had to recuse themselves from any of the conversations on that up until then, because you obviously can't debate something you have a conflict of interest on.
Tell that to the board.
Any more than you can vote on it.
Right. So I was thinking about this. Let me just interject a comment on that one. So a subject matter comes up at the council level. It would be right at that point that the council rep would say to themselves, likely, oops, I might have a conflict here. They would disclose to the other council members that they likely or may have a conflict. They would need to go back to their constituency to discuss the issue, and will come back to the and will not be involved in the discussion until they get clarity that they can.
I'm shaking my head, Ray, because I can't see how we can prevent, how we can speak to an issue before it's actually been posed as a question that can be voted on. How do you?
No, but I think the point that Ari makes, and this is frankly an issue that you know folks within the IPC, myself included, have had with you know, the board from time to time, is that at a certain level, there's no point in abstaining from a vote on the grounds that you've had a conflict, if you've participated so fully in the discussion that you've essentially had the opportunity to sway the outcome.
Right.
You know, I remember that at one point the position that Aubrey is suggesting was not what applied to the board. And I guess the question for Ken is that in fact what applies to the board now?
John.
Morning.
Ken, you there?
Yes. I don't think I have read the board's conflict of interest provisions many times. Steve and I have been having some good dialogue on it, or back and forth on email. But I don't think there's anything that I can remember that talks about what happens in discussions ahead of a vote. There is certainly a mention that a conflicted board member should not discuss and should not vote. But where that comes up in the process and what's to be done if somebody did discuss, and I don't think all that's actually mentioned in the procedures.
Well, this is Steve. My recollection is a little bit different. I filed several comments to the board when they were discussing their conflict of interest procedure, and I think where they came out was that there was a there's a different standard for recusing from a vote than there is from recusing from discussion, which I disagreed with. But I think that's where they may have come out. But I would agree with what Aubrey said. I think that if you are conflicted from voting, you should really not be engaged substantively in the discussion either.
Well, I think it comes down to the individual too, doesn't it, Steve? I mean, if we're hearing that the issue here is exposure, perhaps even liability, legal liability exposure to the individual or to the firm, I would think the individual is going to, even in a discussion, is going to speak up and say, I've got an exposure issue here.
Not if the topic is one on which they can benefit their client by the outcome. That's where you're not necessarily going to have exposure, but you would still have a conflict.
All right, so not an exposure issue, but a conflicted issue.
Like unfair benefit type issue.
Well, in theory, is the client then part of the constituency, even if not a member of the constituency? And maybe that's a bad question.
I mean, it's, you know, I don't know that that's necessarily the case.
Okay.
And I'm also not sure why it would matter. Again, I think I may not be understanding you.
Yeah, and that's not that's let's not go off on that tangent.
Well,
but yes.
This is Steve. I would just say that I think it would make sense that if you spell out, you know, a procedure for conflicts, you might want to say that this should apply to any substantive discussion on an issue on which a person would be prevented by a conflict from voting.
I agree with that. Does anybody disagree with what Steve just said? Anybody on the work team? Okay. I happen to agree with that. To me, that should be part of what we're doing. What I'm also trying to accomplish here is I would like to keep, unless others on the work team disagree, the rules of procedure not so granular, but offer guidance. And I'd like to push the autonomy down to the stakeholder groups to resolve these things. And I understand there could be exceptions that happen at the council level, but really trying to push the autonomy down to the stakeholder groups by providing options to remedy at that level, whether it's naming an alternate, pushing it there, pushing the burden down at the stakeholder group level or constituency group level.
Why?
Why? Because I think when we look at the council, their role is to be, you know, the manager of the policy process.
Right.
Not be getting into the substantiveness of whatever the outcome is to be. So to me, in the spirit of managing the process, you really need to be accountable to who you're representing. So it's who you're representing that you need to resolve this conflict with at that level. And I think that's more true to the spirit of then the council simply acting as the manager of the process.
I understand that perspective. My concern about leaving it entirely up to the stakeholder group is that at a certain level, it would seem to me that the independent of the personal issues, in other words, my personal professional issues relating to conflicts, it would seem to me that one of the goals of having a robust, delineated conflicts policy is to ensure the integrity of the output. And it would seem to me that the best way to do that is to ensure that the policy is consistent across the stakeholder groups. We have no reason to think that they wouldn't all adopt the same measures anyway. But I think if you have a situation where you have different stakeholder groups doing different things in regards to conflict situations, then I think to the extent that one of your goals is in fact to ensure or try and ensure the integrity of the process, that you may not be able to do that.
Okay. All right. But keep in mind, too, that really what we're trying to get to the bottom of is when and under what conditions should the denominator change at the council level. I mean, that, at the end of the day, isn't that really what we're trying to hone in on? When are those specific, and we should consider as rare, circumstances when the denominator needs to change at the council level? That's really the substance of this discussion.
Right.
Or do others have other opinions? And that's what we're truly trying to get our hands around. What can we do in the council rules of procedure to provide direction and guidance while at the same time, again, and these are my words, not the work team's words, but in my words, push the burden onto the stakeholder group or constituency to take on that burden to resolve that conflict before it gets to the council level. And then when all those have been exhausted reasonably,
yep,
then okay, this
sorry,
is
I'm
when the sit. Denominator can change at the council vote level.
Breathing, heavy breathing. Now he's
fine. All right, we've got interference.
Side chat here. Yeah, this is Aubrey. If I can comment once we get through the side chat.
Okay, Aubrey, go ahead.
I think that we've circled around some of the things that can allow us to define that. For example, one, who the request comes from, and making the request. These are mostly going to be in votes that at least a week in advance it's known that the vote's going to happen. And if people have been recusing themselves from discussion because of this conflict, then they'll know far in advance that this is the case. So first of all, perhaps the request can come not from the individual,
but can come from the constituency saying we have a, or the stakeholder group, you know, the probably should come from the stakeholder group, even if it is originating in a constituency, that, you know, we have a conflict of interest that we have not been able to deal with on Councillor so-and-so. And that request goes in. And it goes in long before the vote is actually held. So the abstention is not a surprise during the vote. It, and in fact, you know, with for example, with Christina, you know, she always told early in a conversation, hey, you know, folks, I'm going to have to abstain here. And I mean, we didn't do it 7 days in advance because that wasn't the practice, but it was always something that was known before the vote happened. And so if the conditions are built like that, that the request comes from the stakeholder group, that the request is there at least 7 days before the vote, and that, you know, there should be evidence of a certain amount of recusal. And I don't think you can demand full recusal because sometimes it may only be in the end game discussion that, you know, it's probably not often the case, but there could be cases that it's only in the end point of a PDP that you've been going at it 4 months that something gets said, something gets put in that all of a sudden triggers the conflict of interest. So someone might have negotiated, you know, in the sink for 3 months and then the last month gone, oh my, you know. So, but that kind of conditioning may make it, and if at that point is when the denominator is decreased because it's known way before the vote that it's going to need to be.
Ray, this is Eric. Can I jump in the queue?
Yeah, Eric, go ahead.
Thank you. I keep getting knocked off by the call people who think that I have got too much ambient noise. it's a real pain in the ass because basically it means I'm missing all of the call. You said something about pushing the mechanism for cure down to the stakeholders group. And I wanted to point out that while the registry constituency is very representative of the registries, which have contracts with ICANN, in the registrar constituency, or now stakeholders group, a very small minority of registrars actually are members of the now called stakeholders group. So the notion that here's the real question. Does the council narrowly represent the stakeholder group from which each member arises, or do they broadly represent the ICANN community, which is concerned with their policy area, that is, with generic names? So who represents the interests of registrars who choose for one reason or another, perhaps in my case, I'm just not happy with the corruption, or what I think of as corruption.
Right.
Who represents their interests at the board?
Okay, so I have an answer to that, but I'm going to let others, if they have one, go first. Anybody? Okay, so when I say I think there's an inherent benefit by pushing the autonomy down to the stakeholder group level. It's that for that registrar who feels, hey, I'm not being represented, and you know, by joining my constituency and getting involved, I'm going to get myself represented in this. That's the benefit of it.
I'm shaking my head if you can't hear that from the ambient noise, the rattling. Anyway, I just wanted it to be out there that if the mechanism for cure for problems that exist at the council level for conflict of interest amongst members is constrained to a per stakeholder group mechanism of cure, then conflicts which deal with issues that don't affect the actual members of a stakeholder group don't seem to be resolvable. And I can go on mute now, but I'll probably not be, you know, be lost for the rest of the call if I do.
Okay. Does anybody else have any comments to Eric's point? I think his point is, how does someone who's not a member of a constituency or stakeholder group feel represented in the
council? No, it's not someone. It's for the stakeholder groups, which actually have a very small minority of membership relative to the contracted parties. This is just a contracted house problem.
Okay.
Basically, the problem doesn't exist in the registrar house because all the registries are members of the registry constituency group and now the registry stakeholders group. But in the registrar constituency group, membership has shrunk considerably since 2002. And, you know, I stopped paying dues for reasons of my own. So it's
okay.
Actually a very small minority that's represented.
Okay. I would have comments back to that, but does anybody have any comments on that point? Okay. Well, all right. Let's note that point for now. I do want to try and achieve some results here today because we have Steve and Christina on the call. I want to double back to one question I put out there. Does anybody feel strongly that you have to go to the other house to get permission on a conflict of interest? Does anybody feel strongly on that?
That it should happen or that it shouldn't?
trick question, huh? anybody feel strongly that that should be a requirement? All right. I personally do not. I think that would bog things down and add a layer of bureaucracy and even potential gaming. So if nobody disagrees, let's advise, you know, staff or Ken, who's really helping out with this, or and Julie, that, you know, that's we don't really want to go there with whatever procedures we can come up with for the rules of procedure. High level is Christina and Steve. Any on this issue of let's do whatever we can in the rules of procedure to influence the autonomy to exist at the constituency level to resolve the conflict at that level? Do you guys agree with that notion and approach?
This is Steve. I do, because I think that's where that's the group to which that council member is accountable. And so if a conflict situation arises, I think it would be good for that stakeholder group and or constituency to have the mechanism for resolving it. And if this group thinks that, and if it passes legal muster, that the idea of designating an alternate is a good way to do that, I think you should say that in your report, and stakeholder groups and constituencies should be advised of that.
Okay. Does the group feel we should start to work on some sort of policy formulation on this, advice, if you will, and then throw it to ICANN staff legal to get some initial interpretation on the idea?
Discovery.
Yes?
I'm not sure that I'm comfortable with the notion of the substitute, substitute voter.
Okay.
I think that that's really complicated. I think that a lot of conversation would have to go around either the notion of substitute and proxy. And I know you said that we wouldn't get legal advice on it until afterwards, but I would legal advice on what the conditions for such a thing would be before we put that in. I'm certainly comfortable with going ahead with denominator reduction when I still think it should be the stakeholder group, even if the machinations went on in the constituency, it should be the stakeholder group that brings it, because stakeholder groups are the unit of measure, as it were, but, you know, that one is a small point. So I'm certainly comfortable with the reduction of denominator in particular things and working on that policy. But I think we need to do a lot more on proxy/substitute voters.
Yes, and I want to make clear, Aubrey, actually you just articulated it better than me. I'm saying the same thing as you, is yes, we just want to come up with what we're thinking as a work team on this alternative or proxy, whatever word we want to use. I know proxy is always a word that draws up antennas. But anyway, whatever it is we use, we definitely want to get legal counsel advice sooner, not wait until we are all done and then try and get it. That would be a waste of time. So I agree with you on that. And then my third question is there any disagreement from today's call that in those cases where reasonable methods have been exhausted to resolve the conflict, in the cases where the conflict has not yet been resolved at the council level, that, okay, we can now go ahead and reduce the denominator? Does anybody disagree with that high-level notion?
This is Christina. I don't have a problem with it. I guess I would feel more comfortable with it if I had a better sense of what those reasonable measures were.
Exactly, and that's where the work team is going to have, has their work cut out for them. So this is not a be-all, end-all, final. I'm just trying to get a consensus view if there's any disagreement on this approach. And once we, if we feel we have that kind of consensus agreement, okay, now let's roll up our sleeves. Let's hit, we'll go look at the rubber hits the road stuff, including legal. What are those reasonable measures as a work team? And before any final decisions are made, we'll probably invite you back again or share with you by email, if you don't mind us CCing you on things, where how we're progressing on some of those more, you know, detailed matters.
Ray, this is Ken, if I might.
Yeah, Ken.
I'm happy to continue to help with the pen and with the writing and drafting for the team. I'm only aware at the moment of two mechanisms that have been discussed so far, that a constituency or a stakeholder group might avail itself to resolve a conflict. One was to direct the vote to that counselor and say, you will vote as such, here it is in writing. Now, that may or may not resolve the conflict, depending on the professional ethics and other things that have already been discussed. But it might also apply in certain instances, right? Number two, the only other mechanism I've heard discussed is some substitute, alternate, proxy, somebody, the constituency or stakeholder group says, okay, that voter isn't going to vote, they're recusing themselves, they're not participating in discussions, and when it comes time to vote, that vote's going to be done by this person, and we can try to draft up a set of conditions for how that might take place, what nouns we might use to describe it, and then, you know, run it through the legal department and see if it passes muster. But so far, that's the only two mechanisms I've heard, unless there are others.
Well, I think,
this is Avery.
Yeah, go ahead, Avery.
Yeah, I think the other thing that needs, I think you're right, I think the other mechanism that needs to be described in some detail is the mechanism that makes abstaining and reduction of denominator okay.
Yeah, that's actually provided for. I'm sorry. I was thinking about the remedies rather than...
Right.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. So
but that still needs to be defined in detail also.
Right. And we've got something already drafted that deals exactly with and even provides an example of how that denominator gets reduced.
All right. So, Ken, in your first scenario, let me try and branch it off into two ways, segregate into two things. One, the council rep goes back to the constituent and says, I have a conflict of interest. The constituency group says, is it a material conflict to you in your mind, or is it not a material conflict? So there's a question there. And then the rep might say, no, it's not material. I don't view it as material. So in that instance, perhaps then the rep is required to follow whatever the constituency tells them to do. If it's a material conflict of interest in the mind of the council rep, okay, in that case, it now a new remedy could kick in, which is, you know, passing it off to an alternate or some other way of having somebody else take that vote for them. Does that make sense? So there's a question that comes. What kind of conflict is it? It's still a question, which goes back to Wolf's point. You know, what kind of conflict is it? Is it a material conflict, or is it not a material conflict? I think the stakeholder group has to take responsibility for that. It can't just be I have a conflict. Or, I mean, that's me talking. That's me deciding. Any views on that? We've got silence. Anybody there?
This is Ken. Let me just, in some of the material that we've already prepared, we did make a differentiation between a voluntary abstention that resulted from a non-material conflict of interest. And, you know, in some of the discussion that happened here today, I'm not sure if the qualifiers will stand up. But some of the examples we gave of a counselor said, you know, I'm going to abstain, but it isn't because necessarily I have a conflict of interest, but, you know, I'm not adequately informed on the issue, I haven't participated in the last three discussions, and so forth and so on, and I'm just going to abstain. I'm not going to vote.
Well, now, we all know that would not qualify as a reduction of the... Nobody
okay.
disagrees
well,
with that, right?
I don't know that we've passed that.
I want to ask that now. Steve, Christine on the call. That scenario that Ken just described, we're not talking about that as a reduction of the denominator, right?
That wasn't my... It was not my understanding that is what we were discussing.
Okay. All right.
So then the next question is what defines a material conflict of interest? And just based on some stuff I looked on the Internet, it typically relates to financial problems where my interests are financially enhanced or whatever if I act.
Well, yeah, let me interject again. I'm not sure, and I just want to get an opinion here. I'm not sure we're looking to debate what is. I'm almost like, leave it to the rep. If the rep feels they've got a material conflict of interest, let them say so. I don't think we want to do an investigation or interpret whether it's this kind of, whether it meets the criteria. I think the rep should be able to say whether it is or isn't. No one, I'm not looking to question the council rep.
Sorry, can I comment on that?
Yeah, go ahead.
I think you're right, but I think that giving guidance to what sort of things do constitute that is
so
reasonable.
Examples.
Right, examples,
okay.
or it doesn't need to be extrinsic. It could be intrinsic definitions. But also, I think what I was talking about before, and I'm not sure it's included, is not only the definition of what's material, but the conditions under which that material conflict would have reasonably been expressed. So the things I was talking about before, having announced it a lot in advance, having not taken part in the debate. In other words, and not only that we define the necessity for material and try to give either intrinsic or extrinsic definitions of what it is, but that we also define the conditions upon which calling that and therefore having the reduction in denominator accepted are also given a guidance.
Fair. I don't disagree with that. Anybody have any disagreement with what Aubrey just said?
Nope.
And again, I'm looking to Steve and Christina here because we have you on the call today. I want Steve and Christina to feel comfortable with how we're approaching this. That's important, too.
You'll hear from me if I'm not. You should have no doubt of that.
Spoken like a lawyer. Okay. So we're at our 1 o'clock time slot. I'm feeling comfortable that we have some level of consensus on how we move forward with this and some meeting of the minds. Does anybody have any additional comments on this subject? All right, our next call is scheduled for 2 weeks, and of course I do want to extend to Steve and Christina or anyone else that they feel could be impacted by this particular discussion to continue to join our calls. You're always welcome to join in and help us with this discussion. I like where we're heading. I think Ken has also done very good work. I don't have the action items in front of me. I'm wondering if Julie could help me with what the action items are of this discussion or not.
Yeah, Ray, this is Julie. What I heard was that, and I heard Ken volunteer to take the pen on this, but of course, Ken, if you need help from me, please say so, although you seem to be much more of an expert on this than I am. We need to, staff is helping out to flesh out some additional details. I think, as Aubrey mentioned, providing some guidance of what is a material conflict of interest, how to express and take, you know, the steps to express a conflict of interest, and this can be in the form of guidance as opposed to something mandatory since we're talking about it at the stakeholder or constituency level.
Yes.
And then the mechanism for how to make the reduction in a denominator, assuming the other things have all that, the rest of that process has gone through, we've determined there's a material conflict of interest, the stakeholder and constituencies have done their due diligence based on the guidance, now how do we reduce the denominator?
Mm-hmm.
Did I miss anything, Ken?
No, and in fact, everything that you just articulated has already been written. And I think probably what's missing here is there was we published a draft that went up on the ICANN site in response to the council operating procedures that had dealt with this whole subject. And I think Steve and Christine actually had got a read on that, but I'm not sure many on the work team have looked at it. That paper is kind of long and includes some research elements in it, but there's a section in there that was written to be the council operating procedure material to be actually included in some section to be determined. What I think I'm going to do is I'm going to cut that out and frame that up. I'll make the changes that have been discussed today, especially taking out that approval procedure of the other house, right? And so I'll do some cleanup on that. And is there a wiki, Julie, on this group?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, there is, Ken.
Okay, then how about
if you want to send me what you your revised version of that document, the sort of redacted version, I will also post it on the wiki.
Excellent, excellent. And so that then I would suggest, Ray, that maybe the team could sort of swarm on this language that might actually go into the procedures, and that can be edited and adjusted and things moved around or whatever, but that would give you the grist, I think, for creating the procedure. And then if we have the piece that's nailed down a little bit on how this substitute thing might work, and I'll take a shot at it, we could actually carve that out and send it over to the legal folks and ask them for an opinion on that as to whether that's doable.
Well, I think that's an excellent summary of action steps from this call. I'm sorry, was that Eric?
Yes, it is.
Go ahead.
Could you provide a link to the original where you're taking this excerpt from so that I can check for consistency as well?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, and I read that, and I'll reread it. This is Avi. I read it, and I'll reread it, but I don't remember seeing the things that I was concerned about in it, but maybe I just missed them. So I'll go back and reread it.
Okay, so our two guests with the expert advice, are they comfortable with the direction we're taking?
I think that I'm much more comfortable with this than I was with the previous direction.
Very good. Now, so we have a little bit of work ahead of us. Our next call is not for 2 weeks. We're clearly, you know, not going to be in the 25th range per that resolution. I'll double back to Chuck. I think he's probably already aware of this, that the 25th was a little aggressive. But anyway, I will double back to him so he can inform the whole council of where we're at in some degree of comfort level as to how we're progressing. I mean, we'd rather take the time that's needed than just to meet a date.
Yeah.
And we're not going to extend it. This is top priority. This is number one on our plate. We have other things to work on as a work team, but we're not going to move to those items until this one is somewhat resolved or in some level of completed state. Fair enough?
Yes.
All righty.
Okay, folks.
Thanks very much for inviting us to this.
Yeah, thank
Happy
you.
Thanksgiving
very
to
helpful.
You.
Thank you very much.
Yep,
have a great holiday for those that are having one. And talk in a few weeks.
Thank you.
And thank you, Ken and Julie. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.